I would like to share with you the story here about the importance of our example. Christ starts out, and if you want to turn to Matthew, and this would be the title of the sermon for our fellows recording back there, we can officially begin. The fruits of your good example, because there's an aspect of our example that we may not be aware of at this point. One verse that reveals that, and when I read that a number of years ago, I was quite surprised. Now, I'm sure we've all read the New Testament, and we've read those words, but maybe you were like me, you read it and it didn't strike you. But through life's experience and examples and various things that have transpired in our lives, some of these scriptures will jump out at you later on in a way that you never understood them at the time, that you first read it. So Matthew, the fifth chapter, talks about the Beatitudes, or in other words, the attitudes, godly attitudes that God wants us to have. Being humble, being meek, being merciful, being honest or pure, being peacemakers, very, very important. Verse 9 there, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. And then talks about the persecution that, of course, Satan will want us to endure, just like he did with Christ for what we believe. And then we go on to verse 13, and he gives us, well, let's read verse 12. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so persecuted they the prophets which were before you. And then he gives us some instruction on why he's saying all these things, or bringing out these attributes. And let me add one thing while I'm thinking about it. That sermonette, our sermonette deliverer mentioned, Mr. Armstrong always encouraged us to buy good quality, and he did. There was one thing he always added to it, though, by the best quality that you can afford. And maybe you couldn't afford the $50 there, Joseph, at the time. You paid for it later, but and you saw that, but he said, always buy the best quality you can afford. Otherwise, that means if you go to buy a car, I guess, you know, I should if I leave out the best quality that I can afford, I should be lined up and signed up for a Rolls Royce, handmade, gold-plated, you see. But I can't afford that. Besides, I wouldn't want that, because can you imagine driving into the Walmart parking lot? Don't bang my car! So, that's not a good idea. Anyway, buying good quality is definitely a money saver. I learned that with, you know, being Mr. Handyman around the house. Sears has got a good sale. They're selling these washers and dryers at a pretty good price. Oh, I can't. I'd never pay that much money for a Maytag. Those were years back. When I can buy this, well, the old Sears washer and dryer would run for a few years, and then this would start going wrong, and that would start going wrong, and I'd be replacing belts and electronic controls and sensors, and pretty soon you'd just like, oh, wait a minute, this is not a good deal. So finally, I bought the basic, simple Maytag washer. And I was there with the Maytag repairman, very bored, happily so, thank you very much. And we moved and we beat this thing around, and it just kept running and running and running. finally, you know, I replaced a few things on it, and then it got to the point. But when we just bought a new set of washer dryer, after all these years, we finally got rid of the old Maytag washer and dryer, which were built like tanks. Okay, so moving men come in with our brand new Maytag washer and dryer, and he could, you know, hook it up with a thing on his back, and he could go down the stairs with strap. You know, carry it himself all the way down the stairs, and they installed it. And when they went to pull the old one out, it was like, ooh, this thing took two guys to try to get it because it was so heavily built. Steel in there and everything else. That's why it lasted so long. So I don't know how long my new one's going to last, but it's been working pretty good so far. But that really was a good quality investment. And it not only is it money-wise, but just think of the inconvenience when you go downstairs and your washer leaks or it doesn't work and your wife comes upstairs, the thing won't run. And I got to wash these diapers. Well, the diapers don't wait. They wait for anybody. So now you're going down to the laundromat, and I'm under this thing trying to get it fixed. No good. So the principle is very much there, and God definitely set that example because he knows that that's the way to do things. You don't want to do it half-hearted. Whatever a man sets his hand to do it with all your might, Proverbs. Okay, now verse 13. This is why, and I want to set the stage here for the ultimate verse I'm going to share with you at the end. Verse 13 explains or gives us a preview, if we think about it a little bit, of why we need to have these kind of characteristics, because he said, you are the salt of the earth. If salt has lost its savor, wherewith shall it be salt? You can't salt salt. If it loses that spark and that tang and that flavor enhancement, is the henceforth good for nothing, but it's cast out to be trodden underfoot. So if you're the salt, you're the amplifier. You show forth something. And then verse 14, it helps us understand a little more. You are the light of the world. Okay? Not the person with the best arguments or trying to convert everybody by all the things you have to tell them, and you're always cornering them every chance you get because you want to convert them, which you and I can't do anyway. God has to call them. You are the light of the world. A city that is set on the hill cannot be hid. So everybody sees this example or this light. Now, they may not recognize all the values there. They may not understand everything, but they don't miss it. Neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel, but on a candlestick, and it gives forth light to all that are in the house. So let your light or example by the way we live so shine before men that you may see, or that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven, not hear your good arguments. Lots of people want to make themselves sound religious, but they don't live it. God said, you don't need to open your mouth, you know. We always use this example of the light bulb. And if the light bulb starts flickering up in the ceiling or starts making a buzzing noise, there's something wrong with it. We don't want to be a light bulb that is going on the blink, as they say. We want to be a nice, quiet light that they can see our good works. In other words, following what God says to do. you are the light of the world, he said, and again, let your light shine that men may see your good works by the way you conduct yourself, the way you live, and glorify your Father which is in heaven. Now, a lot of times, you know, certainly when we come to church, we all put on our Sabbath best, you know, we dress up to respect God, and we would be careful in how we conduct ourselves here at church. But when we get out in the world and we think, oh, well, nobody knows what I believe, and if I do so-and-so or I let down over here or whatever, what difference does it make? I'm going to show you that it does make a difference. That's why God says he wants us to set a good example so that people can see our good works. And it's not just among ourselves, but it's in this world, and it has a very powerful effect for the future. Now, let me share with you, and I really appreciate the Beloit News here, and that was the theme of the Beloit News, our personal example and how we represent God. And it's interesting, having been in sales marketing, whatever you want to call it, sales engineer, the articles that the men who are in that profession, they got that right away. Mr. Buckmaster is involved in serving the public with his product and hopefully making their lives better, saving them money, and being a benefit to them. And certainly, his example and his relationship with the customer and his honesty and all these things are, he knows, are very, very important. You certainly don't want to present yourself as a liar to the customer. You're not going to be doing very well financially if you do. You have to be honest. You have to do what you say. And you have to service your product and have good quality. And he understood that. And he wrote about it in his example. Then we had Jim Gillespie, who's the national sales manager for a fastener company, nuts, bolts, screws, all kinds of things like that, down here in Chicago, and has been for many years, travels overseas to China. And he wrote one about a business card. What kind of a business card are you? And he showed how the Asians really respect that card, and because, and they'll take it if you, when you hand it out, and they read it carefully, put it in their pocket, because they realize it represents who you are, and they want to show respect to that. And he used that as an example, because he knows how much a good reputation in business is, how important that is. I mean, you're certainly not going to do business with someone who all your friends have already tried to go and do business with them, and they've been cheated, lied to, and they tell you when you need that kind of service, well, don't go to Joe Schmo over here because he's a liar and he won't do this. That's not a good reputation. That's not a good example. And so you want to have an upstanding example. When God gives guidance for ordination of an elder and a deacon, in both cases, they need to have a good report or a good reputation without. In other words, outside. In other words, in this world, in this society, they can't be known as a two-timer, a liar, a cheat, you know, say one thing, do another. Their reputation is very, very important. Their example, that's who they are. Then finally, Scott Familetti wrote another very good article here. And showed, you know, you have to be living what you believe in, or what, in this case, he he was using the example of selling. You can't just talk the talk. You have to walk the walk. That's in essence what he was saying. So I was impressed by that, and I thought, well, it's time to share this story with you that I experienced and kind of woke me up to how important a good example is and how I was and my dad was and how you are, even though you don't know it, and we certainly didn't know it, affecting the people in this world. And I'll tell you the story about Caterpillar. It was a shocking one, and it was surprising to me and really opened my eyes. My father had called on and done business with Caterpillar for like 40 years. I became an associate with him, also an independent contractor. I mean, we were both independent manufacturers reps. And he turned over part of the territory for me to cover, and later on began to train me or teach me about the Caterpillar account. Now, I'd already worked for a bigger corporation, been a sales engineer, been a key account sales executive, they called it, a sales manager, and then I left the company and went business as a on my own, my dad. Well, that was fine. And I was focused primarily, not wholly, but primarily on Caterpillar and International Harvester. These are very, very large companies. And at that time, Caterpillar had about 13 plants scattered throughout Illinois and one in Indiana, one over in Iowa. And I was spending a lot of time traveling and being on the road because we had the products that we represented. We had not only keep the customer up to date, since we were already established in those accounts and doing business with them, but we had to go out in the plant and service the product if they had any concerns. And so that brought me in contact with up to as many as 200 engineers scattered throughout these different facilities that Caterpillar had. And each one of them, each one of these engineers used our product to one degree or another, and from time to time they'd have problems or questions or they needed new tooling and so on. And so usually I would go to a plant, like the Aurora plant or down in Decatur or Peoria, and I would be in there early in the morning, and I would usually spend all day there. Be out in the menu, you know, you talk to the engineers in the office, and then you go out into the plant, and you look at the machine that they're running on, and you find out what the problem is, and you help them solve the problem. And so it was a very work-intensive thing, and you had to get to know all these things. Well, over a period of a couple of years, my dad and I traveled together to these different plants, and he began introducing to me to the different people, engineering, down in out in the manufacturing area, and you had to get to know each one of them and what they liked and what they didn't like, and you know, you just get to know them and learn how to serve and take care of their needs. Well, one just to give you a jump ahead there, years later I added other product lines after my dad retired, and I remember this fellow was from Oil City, Pennsylvania, where they first discovered oil in this country. And I'd been to Oil City many times in the past, and we were stationed out there in the ministry in Youngstown, Ohio. Anyway, it's one of these little old towns that very small population and up in the hills, and it's nothing too modern, but it's a very small town. And many of the people had never done much to leave that town. And this one company had developed a special cutting tool that I found and brought it in the Caterpillar. They were very happy about it. We began to run tests. And then I brought the owner of the company and his son out to visit people at Caterpillar because this was their special tool, patented tool. Well, now I'm going to talk about the Aurora plant because that's where this particular example that shocked me happened. And I'm mixing a couple stories here together, but I just want you to see how big, I want you to understand how big this one building was that is located in the Aurora plant. Just one building. They had three buildings equivalent to this. When you go into the Caterpillar facility, you go into the lobby, you call, the girl calls the purchasing guy, and you have to get authorized to go up and see the engineering people and so on. Well, you know, they knew who we were, so we got ushered right in. And we go up the stairs. We're all in the office area. We go up the stairs to the second floor, engineering, you know, all the drafting tables lined up with all these engineers. And we start talking to the supervisor and then talking to individual people, and we put a little talk on for them. And this young fellow was with us. Now it was time to go out in the plant and take a look at how this tool worked on the machine. Well, what you do is you're up on the second floor, and you go down this big, wide, you know, railing in the center, but a big, wide stairway, steel stairway. And it's like the one way down, one way up type of thing. And you start walking down below the floor level, you know, down into the main plant, the ground. And your head drops below the floor level, and you look out over this huge manufacturing plant. Now, it's 80 acres under roof. That's a farm. 80 acres, and it's chock full of machinery and lift trucks running around and robotic stuff running and all kinds of machines and things humming and buzzing. And this kid, when his head dropped below, when his head dropped below the floor, he just stopped. Because he didn't realize how big this place was. He'd just been in the office part. And I turned around, what's the matter? This place is bigger than my whole town. And I thought, wow. And that was one plant that they had. And then you had to walk literally a mile to get to their other plant. And it was equally as big, and did all the welding over there, and then they had another one that was assembly. And there were 5,000 people that worked. That was at its peak. That's to give you a little idea of the magnitude of the number of people that we were dealing with. And then there were 12 or 13 other plants equivalently as big, all doing different aspects of building Caterpillar tractors. Well, now I'm going to tell you the other, get back to the example here. So my dad had been calling on this one purchasing, you know, you have engineering, and then you've got a couple, two or three guys in a separate office area that will process the requests of their engineers as far as purchasing is concerned. They maintain the inventory. They make sure they have all the products on the shelf, so that manufacturing can keep going. They don't run out of cutting tools or whatever they need to keep making parts. And so my dad had talked, he'd known these guys for like almost 40 years. And so we'd go in there and talk to them and tell them, okay, we talked to so-and-so engineer, maybe we'd have a guy with us. And we need to order so-and-so in these parts, and we'd talk about what we needed. And then we would, they would always, were more than happy to joke around and kid us and do various things. Well, whenever we went to Caterpillar, we always tried to follow what my dad learned was important to show respect, and that is, we always if other people dressed in sport coats, we dressed in suits. Because we wanted to show the customer that we thought they were, which they were, very important to us, and we want to show respect to them. Wasn't trying to dress up fancy or something. You go out in the plant, before you go downstairs, you would take your coat off and tuck in your tie and roll up your sleeves, and you had to learn to work around these machines without getting your white shirt greasy or getting your tie caught in the machine and strangling yourself. So anyway, all of this background and all the relationship that had been built through many, many, many years was rather good because we had a good reputation there, but nobody really knew what we believed religiously. But this one particular man in that group had a wife who lived in Aurora area and down there in Chicago church area, and she became interested in the truth unbeknownst to my dad or I, and she requested a visit. Of course, we didn't know all this was going on, and you may remember Lowell Foster, who was an elder there, and he went out to visit this lady. Now, this same man, we had just been in that Caterpillar Aurora plant visiting with him and getting around with him and so on that very day. That evening, Mr. Foster went to visit his wife, and of course he was there during the visit, and he wanted to know about the church and the truth and had questions and various things. And somehow, when he said he worked for Caterpillar in the conversation to get to know each other, then Lowell Foster said, do you know Rowan Spies? Yeah, I just saw him this afternoon. He said, well, they're ministers in the church. I knew they had something going for them. And when I heard this, you would say, you should be real. No, I was scared to death. I thought, I hope I didn't do anything wrong. I hope I didn't say the wrong thing. Because you naturally, humanly, are with the people of this society. And you have to hold yourself a higher standard. But you know, you're not thinking about setting this example. You're just trying to do business and whatever and follow God's principles. And immediately it was not elation, it was fear that I hope that now that they know that I didn't do something that would misrepresent what God says to do. Well, this man ended up, that was many years ago, that was back in the 80s. This man and his wife began coming to church, and he's still coming to church today. That's a fascinating, fascinating story. But it shocked me and made me realize that people see this light that Christ is talking about, that men may see your good works. You don't even realize it. They don't even realize. They just know there's something, like he expressed, he just knew these guys were different. He couldn't put his finger on it, though. He didn't know what it was. He just knew that it was different than all the other people that he was doing business with. We didn't see that, but he did. And he saw lots of guys coming through his office representing many, many different products. We had one guy who went around trying to preach. He was handing out New Testaments, and he handed this to, I heard about this later, he handed it to this fellow there and that I was just referring to, and it was the little pocket New Testament, had the New Testament, had the Psalms and the Proverbs, and of course, by this time, he knew better, and he opens the thing up, he says, well, where's the rest of it? you don't need that. And, of course, he was deliberately sticking it to this guy because he knew that that was ridiculous, only, you know, looking at the New Testament. So, that just was an eye-opener, and it began to help me understand another aspect that I want to further share with you. But let's go to 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 20. Today is story day in the sermon, so sorry about that. My wife, I look over it, looked over, she's just shaking her head because... Anyway, 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 20. But personal experiences help us, you know, get down to reality sometimes, and God uses these to teach us and make us aware of, in this particular case, just how much we affect other people and how important that is. Now, we all know this verse, 2 Corinthians 5, and verse 20. Now, then, we are ambassadors for Christ, as though God did beseech you by us. We pray that you, pray you in Christ's stead, be reconciled to God. So, in other words, he's emphasizing the fact that we all need to be close to God, reconciled to God, because we are representatives of God's way, which is what Christ said. You're the light of the world. You're the salt of the earth. Okay? You're in a unique situation, but you're doing it quietly by your example and by the way you live. And that's the way God wants us to represent Him. Now, in 1 Thessalonians, because you're out in the world, you know, the world's used to doing the wrong thing, and you could start doing the wrong thing. Nobody in the world's going to say, "Hey, what are you doing? You're supposed to be a church member." They're not going to be criticizing that. They're going to say, "Oh, good, join us." But boy, as soon as that fan went off, I started sneezing. Excuse me. Okay, 1 Thessalonians 5, and we'll look here in verse 22. Paul's listing off a number of things. In verse 16, he starts saying, you know, we want to rejoice evermore. We want to pray without ceasing. We want to give thanks for what God's given us, and so on down the line. And he says in verse 22, abstain from all appearance of evil. So we have to be so aware of our actions that we would be very, very careful, even if we were doing something that was okay, but could be viewed in a negative way, we want to make sure that we avoid even the appearance of evil. We want to make sure that we don't do anything that could bring criticism against us and what we're doing. And I could, you know, you could think of examples of that. This is why, for example, when our rules for visiting women, for example, in the church, if a woman asks and her husband's not there, or maybe she's not married or whatever, we never visit any woman by herself. Okay, we always have our wife or another minister or a deacon or somebody else along with us, to avoid the appearance of evil, because people could accuse, you know, could be accused people, "Oh, that doesn't look good. Look at, he's going in there by himself, and he spent an hour in there, or 2 hours, or whatever. What's he doing in there?" And that's not what we should be doing. We got to think a little bit. And that's why Paul said, you better make sure you even are so aware of your example that you avoid the appearance of evil. It's just not a very wise thing to do. You don't want to be put in a situation where you're falsely accused or suspected of something you didn't even do because you weren't wise in the way you conducted yourself. All right, let's get down to the key verse here, because this is what it's all leading to. And this is going on behind the scenes. If you go to 1 Peter, the second chapter, this is all going on right now behind the scenes that we don't see. Now, I think about examples of people I hear talking about life and death experiences. They're not members of the church. They don't even understand anything about God. But they will describe a circumstance or a situation which is, if you understand God, you know, and of course he or she recognizes that something more than natural happened, that God intervened some way or an angel did something, because they're saved from death in a very miraculous way. Now you wonder, why in the world would God be intervening in people's lives in that way, in a specific way? Well, obviously God is working out something, and he's working and preparing that person because he wants them to go through whatever experiences, learn certain lessons in this life, so that when Christ returns and his mind or her mind is open, all these experiences that they went through in the past will come flooding back to mind and will give them the help they need to understand the truth at that time. God works with each person in his own way. In other words, he means what is the best way for us. He knows how to teach us and how to appeal to us and how to show us the truth. Then, of course, it's up to us to accept it. But he's definitely, in other words, what was it, what prophet was it that didn't even know about the 7,000 who hadn't bowed the knee to Baal? Was it Elijah? I always forget. But anyway, that example is very clear to me. Here is God's prophet doing these miracles and all these things, and he didn't know what God was doing, something else over here. 7,000 people he's working with in another way. Now, they weren't, maybe at the point where Elijah was, but they were in the process of getting taught the things they needed to be taught so that they could then further understand the truth when it became became revealed to them. Now, here's what Peter understood, and this is what we need to add to our big picture, because all of this thing of an example, why would Christ be emphasizing so much the example that we set? If it doesn't make any difference to the world, they're doing what they want to do anyway. Who cares what you do? Right? Who cares? Well, God's going to use that in a way, and people see it, and they recognize it, but they don't understand what they just see this example, and they're like, it's like this fellow says, I knew they had something going for him. He didn't know what it was. He could just see the fruits of people who were trying to honestly do the job the way Christ tells us to do it. Not perfectly, we're humans as well, but trying to follow that pattern that God has taught us. Verse 11, 1 Peter 2. Dearly beloved, I beg you, Peter says, beseech you, as strangers and pilgrims. Now he's calling us strangers and pilgrims in this world. We're not part of this society. We're ambassadors. What we believe sets us apart automatically. You don't fit into the way other people do things. Well, everybody lies, don't they? I mean, you got to do that. That's the way life is. That's what people say. They don't see anything wrong with it. You got to do what you got to do. Dearly beloved, I beseech you, as strangers and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lust, which war against the soul. So we have to be on guard and not to fall prey to fleshly human desires. desires that are against God. Okay, and then he goes on, verse 12, having your conduct, the way you live, honest. Now, this is very interesting because you got to think about this verse. Making sure that the way you live is honest, genuine, among the Gentiles or the unbelievers. You have to still be honest. Well, they're not in the church. They're in the world. They're carnal. They're this and that. Well, I could cheat them if I want, right? No. You have to make sure that your conduct, he says, is honest, Christian, among the Gentiles who are living among, people who don't understand the truth. It's not their fault. They're blinded right now. But they do have brains, and they have two eyes, and they have two ears, and they see our example. That your conduct is proper among those people in this world, that whereas they speak against you as evildoers, you ever have that happen to you in the church? In the world, I should say, because of what you believe? You know, it's just is like breathing. I remember years ago, and I've used this example before, Mr. Armstrong used it, where he would talk to the business people at a potential feast site or after we'd been there, and he wanted to see, you know, is everything okay and all that. And he said, oh, man, your people are wonderful to work with. They're all great, except for that dumb, crazy religion they have. And, of course, Mr. Armstrong would laugh and says, well, of course, they don't realize this is because of our religion that we treat them that way. So we treat them in an honest way, fairly, set the proper example, do it God's way, even though they speak against us and don't agree with it, can't see why we do things the way we do. But, he says, they may by your good works, your example, which they shall behold, which they're going to observe, they won't know exactly what it is, but they're going to see the good works, the good way, honest way, the way you conduct yourself, not that you try to preach or convert them or whatever, but that you are living a wholesome, honest Christian life and setting a Christian example and showing the fruits of God's Spirit, even though they don't agree with it, they may criticize you, they may be resentful and all these other things, they may by your good works or your example of the way you conduct yourself, which they will see, now this is very important, glorify God when? This is the key thing. In the day of visitation or when Christ returns. Now, when Christ returns, if they're still alive, or if they've been resurrected in the second resurrection, and they see you, hopefully as a spirit being then, there are two ways that they could respond. You were in the church? You want them to respond, wow, I didn't know you were in the church. That's how you want them to respond. And when they respond in a positive way because of the example following God's way that they see, what's that going to do? What is Peter saying here? They shall behold, glorify God in the day of visitation. So all the things that we're doing, all these people we contact in our everyday life, they're aware of your reputation, they know, you know, they're familiar with you. They either have a positive impression or they have not such a positive impression. Now, if their impression is negative because of what we believe, as what the verse says, that's okay. As long as they respect us for for following the principles of God, that we're honest, that we're of pure, he says, honest among the Gentiles, that we do it in a pure way, with a pure heart, and do it God's way. That is going to cause them to be much more responsive to the way of God, right? Is it going to be, oh, wow. Oh, you were in it. Yeah, I remember you. And this is why we need to think about this thing in a bigger picture. Because what we live every single day is not only affecting us and our relationship with God, but potentially down the road could be affecting and helping, hopefully helping in a positive way, many hundreds of people that we contact and we're not even aware of. When Christ comes back and God does open their mind, it's going to be a positive influence on helping them respond positively and be willing to respond in a positive way to God's truth.